It's January 29th. It's Friday. That means it's another edition, this time the 54th edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. This is where I, John Zogby, and my partner and son, Jeremy Zogby, take a look at the world, focus on some polling, react to things not only unscripted, but unrehearsed, unplugged, on everything.
Yeah.
How are you feeling this week?
Unconventional.
Unconventional, okay. Unorthodox. I got a few things. First of all, some housekeeping. We will be doing our first poll of 2021 in a couple of days, actually, and we'll have results that we'll be talking about, kind of a wide variety of results, taking a look, obviously, at the new presidency, and then also taking a look at a number of the things that I'm sure you want to just hint at a little later. That means that there will also be another edition of the Intelligencer,
yeah,
which is proving to be pretty popular. So what I want to talk about today is polling and the meaning of democracy. I think that's a very important one. Talk a little bit about the limits, perhaps, of populism and social media as reflected on Wall Street and Reddit this week. And then I know you have some things on your mind. What do you think?
Oh, I would like to talk about populism. You want me to go ahead?
Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Well, I've been thinking about, as we enter this new decade, what was the last decade, right? How is it going to be written in history, 2010 to 2020? And there's an unmistakable trend, and you just talked about it. It's populism. There are synonymous dichotomies. I mean, we could talk about the establishment versus populism. We could talk about the centralization of power versus decentralization of power. These forces are constantly butting heads throughout history. And to me, the last decade, it was really obvious. So I think we need to go back to about 2011 and see 2010, 2011, and see what happened to understand what's going on today. And the way I see it is you had Occupy Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
You had the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
Occupy Wall Street, maybe not entirely directly, but inevitably led to the rise of Bernie.
Mm-hmm.
The Tea Party, again, not directly, but inevitably led to the rise of Trump. And so that's in the political world. That also was impacted by the economics of the time. Then there's technology, right? There was the rise of cryptocurrency. There was the rise of these retail trading platforms, like we just saw the major headline this week. And so that all fits really into that dichotomy of the forces of centralization versus the forces of decentralization, populism versus the establishment. What I noticed this week, and this had never dawned on me, and quite frankly, I don't think anyone really has made this connection, but I'm going to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, but for the first time in our nation's history, you had a major populist movement on both sides of the ideological spectrum. On the left, it was Bernie. This mm-hmm. was not a small thing.
Mm-hmm.
This was a force to be reckoned with. Bernie was a major contender in both 2016 and 2020. Many of his fans are convinced that he was shafted both times. The Tea Party, which started out with Ron and Rand Paul and that circle, and then kind of fizzled out because it was, it was taken over by people like Sarah Palin and maybe Glenn Beck and other people, and then that kind of fizzled out, And then it culminated in Trump, and Trump won the presidency. So again, think about this. When was the last time American history saw two mainstream, almost mainstream, populist movements that were forces to be reckoned with at the same time, coexisting within the same decade? And so I'll dive into that more as we go back and forth, but I wanted to set the table of think about how amazing that is, how remarkable that is. And we could even talk about the roots of it, but why don't you jump in?
Okay, so first of all, I think you raise a very good and important historical point. You mentioned this point to me about the two simultaneous populisms and high impact populisms.
Yeah.
And frankly, just combing through American history that I know, I couldn't come up with one. You know, we've had major populist moments, but not, and we've had party realignments.
Yeah.
And demographic changes, but not like this. I want to take your observation one step further and get into, because it's relevant now, what I wanted to talk about, which is, have we come to a point where elections don't matter anymore? So just looking at 2020, Joe Biden got a majority of the popular vote. That's a majority of the popular vote. And according to the rules of engagement, even though a number of battleground states were close, they weren't so close that, I mean, they weren't 19 votes or 152 votes. Wisconsin was 21,000 votes. Georgia was 13,000 votes, multiple recounts. Arguably, Joe Biden won by most accounts, a majority in the Electoral College. And today, a week and a little bit into his presidency, his average in the polls is 51-52% approval. Those are the sorts of numbers we haven't seen in a while. A majority approve of the job that Joe Biden is doing. Where the polls diverge is the range that they report of disapproval. And so anywhere from 30-31% disapproval to 48% disapproval, according to Rasmussen. But all the polls on the approval side are between 49-52. So where we stand right now, January 29th, with a new president, is a president who is a majority president. And what I don't understand then is, why does this president not get a honeymoon? Why does he not get cooperation? Why is there a reluctance on the part of the GOP, the other side, to not simply say, we lost? Now, let's parse the GOP argument. Trump got 47% of the vote. That's a lot. Okay, we didn't lose seats in the House of Representatives. We gained seats. So those are very tight in the House, and it's about as tight as you can get in the U.S. Senate. We still matter. But in a democracy, I don't know that it can function if there isn't an agreement on the rules of engagement. And the rules of engagement, I think, clearly say somebody's got to win and somebody has to gracefully and graciously lose.
Yeah.
And that's not happening. And that's troubling because obviously we don't have to even list them. You've got COVID-19 that is getting worse. You've got a distribution problem with the vaccine. You've got an economy where people really need help.
Mm-hmm.
Individuals, small businesses. You have an infrastructure that not only is just crumbling, it's been crumbling for years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've got catch up that has to be played in terms of both energy independence and at the same time climate change. You have all of these problems facing a new president, and you have gridlock. 8 days into his presidency, 8 days into a majority presidency. That's very troubling to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so is the question, where does this all stem from, or why is this happening?
Oh, I know where it stems from.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, this goes back, well, look, this is our history to a great degree, but this degree of, let's call it, rejectionism or obstructionism, I think probably dates back to Bill Clinton. And even though Clinton had the political skills to maneuver his way through Congress with the advice of Dick Morris, triangulate. Translated, don't battle them on their issues, steal their issues, and you're the president of the United States. Claim them as your own. I remember I was advising I'm a Democrat, but I was advising the House Republicans at one point, and the leadership was whining, he's stealing our issues and getting all the credit.
Yeah.
And I said to them, stop whining. You know, take credit yourself, share the spotlight. Nobody elects whiners. Whiners are losers, you know? It's another point. But we get into George W. Bush. I don't mean to make this partisan, but Bush, particularly after 9/11, had some strong bipartisan support on education. Obviously, even though the country had been split 2 days before, we went to war in Iraq, and Democrats rolled over in Iraq. Barack Obama becomes president, rejectionism again. What's the number one goal, according to Mitch McConnell? To make sure he doesn't get a second term. I think we've been heading towards this trend, but with the high-intensity populism of both sides, we've come to a point where there is a Grand Canyon-like chasm.
It kind of goes back to that theme that I opened up with, the forces of centralization and the forces of decentralization at play. You know, I was a kid during the 90s, but the one thing that I remember from the 90s was things were just constantly getting more awesome. Movies were getting better. The graphics were getting better. Stores or chains that we heard of only in the big cities started coming to the little cities. And it was exciting. Malls were huge. They were growing. They were becoming super malls, right? And, you know, Clinton, in my opinion, the 90s appeared great, not so much politically because of Clinton's political maneuvering, but probably more so because of Alan Greenspan and the so-called Greenspan put that really ushered in this economic bubble that we didn't realize, or many of us didn't realize, was a bubble that was eventually going to come crashing down, that George W. Bush inherited. Now, you mentioned the point that after 9/11, Bush had something like, 90% approval, right?
After
89% after 9/11.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it crashed down to something in the 20s. And then by the time at the end of George W. Bush's presidency, the bubble pops, right? And so all hell is about to break loose, and then Obama gets into power. And listen, I was very high on Obama. I mean, I was living overseas, and I was living overseas at the end of the Bush presidency, and I carried this weight on my shoulder. I felt like I did, of the ugly American, you know? I'm not going to say that everybody hated Americans where I lived, but you could feel it. People were sick of the United States. And then I was in the Czech Republic. I was living in Prague and bouncing around Europe. And Obama gets on the scene, and I was very high on Obama. I thought he was going to be the political savior. I remember the day when it became obvious that he won, mm-hmm. that we knew for sure, all right, that he's elected. I walked outside, and there were clouds, and the sun was behind the clouds, but I didn't see the clouds. I just focused on the sun, and I felt the warmth, and I thought, this was a good day. And I just felt this weight, a catharsis, a weight lifted off my chest. And, I mean, within about a year, that all started to crash. And, I mean, look, Obama was elected because of hope and change. He promised to people that there was a new way, that was a new movement that was going to come into town, and there was going to be a new political coalition. There was going to be new people, but then Too Big to Fail happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people say, well, look, they were too big to fail. But there are a lot of people who say, no. They weren't too big to fail. They were too big to jail. Mm. And so for a lot of people, that was the unmasking of Obama, their perception. It was the unmasking of Obama. It was basically George W. Bush was a con man, and now Barack Obama is a con man. And so those two presidencies that promised a lot, I mean, George W. Bush promised a bipartisanship after 9/11. That fell apart. We went to an extreme low. We went to a high with Obama, and he made a lot of promises. And for a lot of people, he ultimately failed. And so I contend that those back-to-back presidencies of W. and Obama are directly responsible for this massive amount of populism on both the left and the right, because it happens right during the Obama presidency.
So I'm gonna jump in here and not disagree with you at all. I'm gonna add, of course, as we've mentioned over and over again, there are other factors weighing in, not the least of which is fast-paced technology, changes, tremendous changes in the workplace, not simply distrust or disappointment in the president or the presidency, the United States. At the same time, in that period during the Obama presidency, actually the Bush and the Obama presidency, the popularity of Congress is at 7%, according to us and Gallup. To put that into context, popularity of O.J. Simpson in the mid-1990s was 16%. Wow. Okay, so that's pretty bad for Congress. So you have Catholic Church scandals, right? You have Boy Scout scandals. There is a sense things are really coming apart. You have an already jaded, for mainly economic reasons and then demographic reasons, an already jaded white working class population. Now the largest age cohort, millennials, they put their trust in Barack Obama. And they're disappointed. They still voted for him again. You know, Obama came back and won a majority in 2012, but there was a sense that expectations had been dampened. The table was set clearly for a populist, for Donald Trump, a master, not only the media, but a master of the social media that wagged the tail of the major media. Mm-hmm. I mean, to put it bluntly, this was a dream come true for CNN and for Fox. So when did they ever see numbers like this except when Trump was on the stage? And when did Trump ever leave the stage?
Yeah.
A perfect storm. But we are at a moment. On one hand, we can stop and say, this is a dirty, nasty, terrible system and establishment we have. Good. It should crumble. On the other hand, we say, but while it's crumbling, we have a lot of people who are in need, and in need immediately, not 3 weeks from now, you know, not the second quarter, but right this minute. And how do we resolve that unless there are enough folks out there who say, we need help and we have to get it now. And if they can't get it from a majority president, if a majority president not only is going to be rejected, but there are still members of the opposition party who are rallying around Trump. I mean, Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader, went down to Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah. There are people still rallying around Bernie. I mean, if it were possible, I don't see how it's going to, but if Bernie could run in 2024, I predict he would be immensely possible. I don't know that he will have his...
But I've never heard Bernie reject the outcome of an election.
Well, I'm talking about the rank and file.
Yeah.
I mean, well, in their sense, the Democrats won, so that's better than Trump winning. But I'm just saying that I'm taking this back to that rage that's boiling over on both sides. Remember, it's on the populism, that the frustration is on both sides. And, I mean, you could really go to Wall Street and say, well, that's a really good example of why we are where we are today. They got bailed out. Remember, I said in a lot of people's minds, it wasn't that they were too big to fail, it was that they were too big to jail. And so we look at this week. I mean, you were talking about what about all the common people? What about all the, you didn't say us little guys, but you know, what about us little guys? A lot of them feel that they are where they are because the system has ignored them. The system immediately comes to the rescue of Wall Street, and we saw that again. So here with this GameStop story, you know,
talk about that.
A bunch of people, and we don't know necessarily where they stand ideologically. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're gamers, we know that. I mean, I don't know if they're alt-right. I don't know if they're Bernieites, whatever. They're gamers. They saw an opportunity where this hedge fund, what was it, Melvin? Melvin Hedge Fund was, got really complacent and was really positioned for this short sell. And they said, hey, let's drive up the price. And let's not only make a lot of money, but let's also have Goliath fall.
Yeah,
right?
Screw him.
And so we're also still not sure to what extent other hedge funds got involved to exploit that, you know, to get rid of, you know, another hedge fund to position themselves better. But nonetheless, I mean, if you go to this that group within Reddit, you could see that they coordinated this. And
is this a good thing?
Well, let's go to what happens, right?
Yeah.
Before we say whether it's a good or a bad thing. Immediately, the White House comes out with a press release. We're keeping an eye on this, and Melvin is bailed out, billions of dollars. And so, over the last 10 years, you got people who have gone underwater, who've lost their mortgages, who've lost their jobs, who've gotten poorer. I mean, I'm not talking about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. I'm talking about probably tens of millions of people who are poorer today than they were. And time and time again, Wall Street is bailed out. They can't suffer, but we can suffer. And so if you're asking whether it's a good thing, well, if you're one of those people who have almost zero prospect of a future, of attaining the American dream, it probably looks like a really good thing to see the mighty fall, right?
What if you're a smaller investor, and you see your investments are your 401k, your IRA, your mutual funds, your market portfolio, 40,000, 100,000, 250,000, you're saving for retirement. Should you be shaking in your boots right now that once again, rules of engagement are such that things could be volatile, but rules of engagement are such that big guys are going to be bailed out and let the chips fall where they may for me. Is who wins from what happened here?
Well, I mean, you go back to 2008. right? Mm-hmm. I think we're in that moment again where people are really worried about how they're positioned, right, with their 401ks. And I mean, just a year ago, they probably saw anywhere from 30 to 40% of it drop. Right now, it went back up, but it's a scary moment. It's scary, especially because, and again, this is probably going to be a lot of those people who have gone populist.
Mm-hmm.
They could see it vanish away, but you ask them, who won't see their wealth vanish away? Wall Street.
You raised the...
I just say one more thing, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But just like Obama came out and saved and bailed out Wall Street, we now have the former vice president within the Obama administration who's now president and has already bailed out this one hedge fund. I think it's pretty clear that he'll bail them out again. What if we have another long-term capital management moment, another Bear Stearns, another... the Lehman Brothers moment, they will get bailed out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's if anything, that's going to up the ante on the populist rage.
You raised a kind of a seemingly small point, but it's actually a very big point. We've got to know more about who these, I'm going to call it the Reddit guys, okay? Who are they? I wonder who they are. You know, some of them made $8,000, but there were hundreds of thousands
mm-hmm.
of them. But who are they ideologically, right? Politically? Are they not political at all? Are they mischievous? Do they have tinfoil hats? Well, I'd like to know a whole lot more about who they are.
You know, just to take, I'm listening to you. Yeah, that's fascinating. But I mean, just on the flip side, I'd like to know more about these major hedge fund traders, you know, and the lifestyles that they lead.
You know,
I mean, that would be pretty fascinating to see. You know, what do they talk about? How do they live? I mean, we kind of know how they live, but
you watch Billions on Showtime?
I don't even know about it.
Okay. We'll have Bobby on someday. I can't think of his last name,
uh-huh.
Bobby. But anything else today?
There's a lot to talk about. Oh yeah, yeah. I'll say one more thing about this opposing ends of the populist political spectrum. I maintain that they have more in common than what they realize.
Mm.
And I'm going to explore this in the 13th issue of The Intelligencer. My hypothesis from reading into the Bernie camp and reading into the Trump camp is that they're both anti-war, they're both anti-Wall Street, they're both anti-establishment. They're both if you're anti-war, then you're more than likely pro-peace. But I mean, right there, that's a pretty huge platform to come together on. There are potentially other areas where they share some common ground, but I mean, at the end of the day, it's their lifestyles that are very different. You know, maybe your typical Bernieite is someone who aspires to live in a loft, and your typical Trumpster, younger Trumpster, aspires to be a truck driver or a deer hunter or a blue collar worker. And so maybe one tends to be more rural, one tends to be more urban, but isn't that fascinating that they can come together on so many issues, potentially? I'm going to explore that.
Okay. And we've got our Neo-Tribes work that we're continuing?
Yes.
You know? Okay. So on a personal note, someone wrote in and commented on the cup that I used last week. We do this at the wonderful Thinkabator in Utica, New York. And basically, I just go to the shelf and pick out a cup, and I never even noticed. Today, I made a point to pick out a pure white cup. Now, that I didn't side with the white Russians, that doesn't mean I'm a reactionary or counter-revolutionary, just a white...
A Menshevik?
Nothing. Just this actually says Virgin America Refresh 2009. Well, the coffee was good.
It's funny. I got a comment, too, yeah, about my ball jar. I bring it from home, so...
So they're not sponsoring this podcast?
No, but I'm hoping that they send me a lifetime supply.
Yes, so. Okay. Well, Ball, if you're listening, you're getting free advertising every week. Have a good week. Number 55 next week.
We'll see you then. With data.
With data.